It's April 17th in the NBA. We are halfway through the play-in and only a couple days away from the first round of the NBA playoffs. As always, I'm Alexander J, and this is the NBA Recap Show here on the Mojo Sports Network. Full panel today, I've got Yuri Bilcic, Tom Dev, Julian Balthazar. We're going to look very briefly at the two play-in games today. The Lakers eking out a disastrous loss for the New Orleans Pelicans as they lose Zion Williamson to injury. And maybe it's time for the Warriors to wrap it up. They get blown out by the Kings. We're going to touch on that and then preview each eight of our series, four in the Eastern Conference, four in the Western Conference in the first round. We've got some rivalry matchups like the Bucks and Pacers. We've got throwbacks to last year's matchups like the Nuggets, Lakers. It's about to be a hell of a postseason in the NBA. There is nobody on earth I would like to talk to more about it than the three blokes sharing my screen today. We'll start with you, Jules, because we haven't seen you in a couple of weeks. What's happening? Did you watch basketball today?
That's all I've been doing today. So I've been so excited to talk to you three blokes about basketball. I think we had a fantastic few games today and would love to delve deeper into them.
Tom, what's happening, my friend?
Not much. I'm just, you know, spending the day trying to do a bit of a deep dive into Reggie Miller's brain and trying to work out why you should miss a free throw when you're up three with about 2 seconds left. But, you know, Twitter was onto it. They worked out that Reggie's not a mathematician or an analytics guy. Who would have thought?
I conveniently left that out of the run sheet for today because I was so annoyed. I saw that. And Yuri Bilcic, what's happening with you, my friend?
Yeah, going good. Thank you, Alex. And like Julian, watched both games today and saw, of course, the Lakers hold on really by the skin of their teeth in that final period against the charging Pels. And, of course, what happened today with the Kings blowing out Golden State after probably what was, I think they got within about one early in the second half, 56 to 55, and then just completely unraveled from there and really told, right, especially the Kings missing two critical pieces to their bench. Well, one being a starter and, of course, one being the potential sixth man of the year, and still they had enough to get the job done.
All right, let's touch really briefly on both of those games. So firstly, we'll spend 2 minutes on each. The Lakers and Pelicans game today. Zion Williamson scores 40 points, but left the game with 2 or 3 minutes remaining with an apparent hamstring injury. He goes up. It was a dunk at the rim, comes down and just felt something wrong, subbed himself out straight away. The Pels, I think, were tied at that point. I could be wrong, maybe 2-point difference. And they fall away by four in a tight finish, 110 to 106. Just looking at the lead tracker now, the Lakers were up by 11 with about 7 minutes remaining, and the Pels got it all the way back to even before Zion left the game. Charging was the word you used, Yuri. That is exactly how it felt. The Pels were coming. I was sending Pelican GIFs in all my group chats on Facebook Messenger, on WhatsApp. I was so ready to be a fan of this team, and it was such an unfortunate injury to Zion. Hopefully, it's not super serious. At point of recording, I don't think we have a grade or if he's available in the next game. But Julian, I know you watched all this game from home. Tell us about what you saw.
Yeah, charging is probably a good word from Yuri, but I actually felt from watching this game that the Lakers kind of had it, and I felt like they were the superior team. And I thought, you know, at the start, the Pelicans got off to a pretty good start, but then in the second quarter early, that, you know, Lakers got out to a 15-2 run. It sort of separated them a little bit. The Pelicans, they tried to double team a lot, I noticed. And I think, you know, Alvarado as well, I know he's such a fantastic player and he's very exciting with all his steals and stuff, but he kind of got in D'Angelo Russell's face really early and he kind of spurred on the wrong player, I think. I mean, D'Lo, I think he hit about 3 or 4 threes. I think he ended up with
5 of 11. Yeah. Sort of,
yeah, 5 of 11. He got the wrong player riled up, I reckon. Like, I think if you're going to do that, you need to back it up. And I think the Lakers, they look like bullies out there. I mean, Anthony Davis, comparatively to Larry Nance, who actually played quite a decent game, I just thought it looked a bit like boys against men a little bit there. And I'm actually surprised that they actually got back in it. And even Hachimura, like, he was playing more of a defensive role. I think he was sort of pushed up a little bit out on the key, which is why he only ended up on, I think, one rebound for the game when he's been averaging about 6 or so in the last 10 to 15 games. So I think he was, you know, he was doing quite a good job on Ingram and McCollum. And McCollum, as we know, he went ice cold from the game. I think it was 2 out of 12 at one point. And yeah, I don't know. I just thought that the Pelicans probably made some strategic errors here. And I know I'm not the head coach and I'm not Willie Green, but I thought the choice to leave Ingram out of the last quarter, at least in the crucial minutes, was a bit demoralizing for himself. You saw a vision of him on the bench and he looked like he wanted to be involved. And I think even when Williamson went off, I think they brought Dyson Daniels or someone in, or they brought CJ McCollum back. And, you know, people might say, okay, Ingram, he was negative 16, you know, at the time that he was on the bench. But, you know, when the game's tied and you have a closer or a clutch player like Ingram, and just to see him on the bench felt a little bit sorry for him, and I thought, you know what, the Pelicans deserve to lose this here. So I don't know. I thought the Lakers were the better team, and it looked like they were in it to win it from the start. And the Pelicans, yeah, they made a late comeback, but I think the strategic errors there late show that they really weren't in it to win it.
Yuri and Tom, feel free to jump in. The New Orleans Pelicans have struggled all year with getting Zion Williamson and Brendan Ingram to play at the same time. I can kind of see the coach's perspective. Zion was cooking, borderline unstoppable. He was 17 of 27 from the floor. The majority of that came at the rim. His guards were fairly patient, like just probing in the paint, waiting for him to get a slot cut or something. Like Zion was unstoppable, but I think you're right, Julian. Have Ingram sit out when Zion's on the floor is not helpful. Tom and Yuri, I don't know if you watched this game. We were talking very briefly offline about the result. Tom, your thoughts, then we'll go Yuri.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the Zion experience wrapped up in one bundle. I mean, just when it, you know, hits its peak of its powers, it's then just completely struck down and you're just left disappointed, because I've never been more impressed with him in that game.
Me
He
too,
could have
yeah.
easily put the Q in the rack. Like down, what, I think they were 18 at one point or something like that. They were completely out of it. I mean, CJ McCollum and Brandon Ingram were not doing a whole lot, hence why they were on the bench. Zion could have easily gone, you know what, we haven't got it tonight. We're going to have to play Kings or Warriors in a couple of days. Let's just rest me up and let's get ready for that. Instead, put his head down, was just fearless. And, you know, I really thought he was going to will them home at the end there, because every time he went down the floor, he was scoring. And then he pulled up, you know, with that floater. It looked like a nothing injury, really. And then went to the locker room, threw the towel at the bench, and was furious. And then we never saw him again. And once he was gone, the Pelicans really had no one else. I mean, we can touch on this at the end of the playoffs, but I think the Pelicans do need to make some roster changes, because I think now they can tell Zion is going to be their one. They now need to get him a better two. From a Lakers perspective, I mean, this is interesting, because all the talk, especially on those ESPN stuff, was all like, hey, they should probably lose this game, risk it, go play Kings or Warriors at home, and then go on to play OKC, which I actually wouldn't have minded that, because I genuinely believe that they could beat OKC in a 1-8 matchup, which we can touch on later, but I don't give them much of a chance at all for beating the Nuggets. But again, LeBron, you know, going 2 games back when he played the Pelicans for the last regular season game, he had like 11 assists in the first quarter or something. It's, you know, this is the time of the year where we get playoff Bron. And who knows? This Lakers team could be swept by the Nuggets. They could push them to seven. We could see the Lakers in the conference finals, and I wouldn't be surprised. Like, no one knows. But at the same time, Anthony Davis seems like he's on an injury report every other day. But game itself, it was exciting, and this is the Zion I want to see for a whole season.
Yeah, Yuri, wrap us up on this game, then we'll touch on the Warriors and Kings.
The 3-point shooting for the Lakers was exceptional, right? That first half, they shot 10 of 20, and whereas I think the Pelicans were 4 of 16 in that, really told a difference in that first half. And D'Lo, D'Angelo Russell, just got completely hot in that first quarter with those 13 first quarter points. And I think LeBron's passing, right? We saw it numerous occasions right throughout the game. He had 9 assists, 23 points, 9 rebounds. He only shot right 6 of 20, but it didn't matter so much, because his whole floor vision when pushing the ball up the floor was just, it's always been exceptional, right? He hit, I think it was Jackson Hayes with a bullet feed that led to a dunk. There was another brilliant pass where he zipped it to Austin Reaves cutting for a layup. And it's those passes that just completely caught the Pelicans off guard. And I think it's just really sort of demonstrates, right, that yeah, he didn't have the best of shooting nights, but his whole facilitating is such a major barometer, because the Pels did try to throw two guys on him to take the ball out of his hands. And of course, Anthony Davis was around the rim, and his big offensive rebound right in that last minute of the game, which proved so pivotal, and him knocking down those four clutch free throws down the stretch to ultimately ice it, right, when he was basically sort of nursing, you could say, as a back injury from that hard fall in the regular season finale against the Pels only a couple of days ago. I think that's just the real sort of big part to it all with the Lakers, those two performing as usual. But Russell's three, right? That last clutch three from the baseline on the Pelicans side of the bench to knock it down, put the Lakers up four with about a minute and a bit left in the game, basically punctured the sort of the air out of the Pelicans' sails. But I think with the Pels as well, the whole, I think, the stem of their run came from late in the third quarter. They had a 2-for-1, which they executed. Trey Murphy hits that big 30-footer three, and then they get a defensive stop on the next Lakers offensive possession. And then I think Zion split one of two free throws, and they were only trailing by about 6 heading into that final period. And I think just the momentum from there just really transcended. And Alvarado hit a big three there too. Trey hit another high arcing three to get them level. And they got level 4 times in that second half to Pels, but just weren't able to crack it. And I think that's where it sort of comes down to sort of the whole execution thing with the Pels too, and which was probably just a little bit waning, especially when Zion went down with that left leg injury, which the Pels are calling as left leg soreness. So that's just one to sort of keep an eye out too. But that's Julian now too, with Brandon Ingram only playing 25 minutes. CJ McCollum was on the bench, I think, for 7 or 8 minutes to start that fourth quarter. And they really rode, of course, Trey Murphy for about 31 minutes, Alvarado, Larry Nance Jr. with Valanciunas playing pretty sparse minutes. So yeah, I think we'll see what happens right in that next final playing game against Sacramento.
Should be a lot of fun. The second game of the night was the elimination match, the Golden State Warriors up against the Sacramento Kings. The Kings eliminating the Warriors in the 24-point loss. It was 94 to 118. Keegan Murray starred 8 of 13 from distance for his 32 points. Domantas Sabonis had 16, 12, and 7, completing my multi, which I was very happy about. Klay Thompson, notable for the Warriors, 0 for 10 from the floor, 0 points in what is potentially his last game in a Warriors uniform. Julian, start us off here.
Yeah, what an interesting game to watch. I feel like the Warriors in the locker room, they would just want this game again. I think it just didn't really look like they got it going from the start. I mean, as you said, Keegan Murray got hot from the start. He had 3 out of 3 threes to start the game. And Trayce Jackson-Davis looked super nervous when he started. He was off within 6 minutes and didn't see another minute till the fourth quarter, I believe. So what it did was it forced Golden State to play Draymond a little bit at the five. And it looked like Sabonis played a little bit of bully ball on him, which he wasn't prepared for. And just watching this game and observing, I noticed that. And I don't know if this is from the Warriors just not understanding each other's positions, but when Draymond was at the five, it looked like no one else wanted to rebound the ball. And it kind of left a lot of room for the Sacramento Kings to get offensive rebounds. I just noticed that visually, but then they started actually talking about it on the stats with the Kings. I think they had 6 or 7 offensive boards with 8 minutes to go in the second quarter. And the Warriors, I don't think they had any offensive rebounds in the first quarter. So no one was boxing out. And it was just, you know, the amount of space that the Warriors gave to the 3-point shooters at the Kings, they will probably want it over again if they watch back the tape. It's just laughable some of the space that they were giving to Harrison Barnes and Murray. And, you know, they just will look so disjointed. And, you know, two big steals from Keon Ellis and Fox rattled them a little bit. And I don't know, I thought Chris Paul came on a little bit late and he only saw 9 minutes in the first half, which I thought a veteran like him probably could have had a bit more influence on the game as well. So I think there's all these lineup changes that the Warriors look so disjointed and unfamiliar with their plays. And here's where my controversial opinion comes into play. And this is what it's all about, debating whether or not, you know, things we see things from different points of views. Before the game, I actually noted this. I said that the Warriors will not win this game with Kuminga getting too many minutes. And a lot of people will go, well, hang on. Kuminga played one of the best games for the Warriors. Like, you know, he scored quite a few points. But for me, I watched a lot of Warriors games. And the Warriors, I looked into this last night. They're 6-2 without Kuminga in the team. And I know he's a fantastic player and he's developing and he's going to be a great player. But I tell you what, from watching a lot of Warriors games, this guy, and this is just my opinion, I know not everyone will agree with this, but he just ruins the offensive flow of the Warriors. He does these things where he takes low quality shots and they put a lot of isolation plays onto him. So Sabonis was sort of like playing off him a little bit, and then Kuminga was pulling up, he was driving to the ring, and credit to him, he scored 6 or so in a row and he kind of got the Warriors going a little bit. But I think he was minus 18 or so for the game as well. And I think when he does this, the other players just get a little bit stagnant. And, you know, Curry goes into his shell, Thompson goes into his shell, and they're kind of just watching Kuminga do his thing. And I don't know, I thought it made them look a little bit, I don't know, just sort of lost a little bit. And they probably could have given a bit more trust into Trayce Jackson-Davis, which has been working over the last 10 games in their runs. So that's just my personal opinion, but would love to hear what you guys think on it. And yeah, the Warriors, as I said, they would love to have that game again, especially Klay Thompson, who went very cold.
Jordan Kuminga minus 22 in 27 minutes.
There you go.
Tom, what do the Warriors do this offseason? I didn't prepare you for that question, but what the hell?
Oh, don't worry. I'm prepared for it. Ever since game 6 of the 2022 NBA Finals, I've been preparing for the Warriors' downfall. You best believe it. Just on Kuminga quickly, the word I would describe is ball stopper. He gets the ball and he takes a shot. He's
Jordan
like,
Paul symptoms.
Yeah, he's a hybrid basically between Marcus Morris and Michael Porter Jr. in a sense. Like, he gets that ball, you know it's not going to anyone else. And that's not what the Warriors system is. And that's why he's been so in and out of their lineup. But no, for the Warriors as a whole, I mean, is the dynasty over? I mean, they got blown out by the Kings today. That was never really close. It felt like every time you watched the Kings were getting an offensive rebound. Over their last 2 seasons, they're 90-74, which isn't great. I mean, it's not horrendous, but it's not great. But then you look at the West teams. You got the Thunder, Nuggets, Timberwolves, Mavs, Pelicans, Rockets, Grizzlies, Spurs, who are all probably going to be just as good, if not better, than what they are this year. Especially like the Grizzlies and the Rockets. They're going to be much better next year than what they are this year. And you still got the Suns and the Lakers and the Clippers. So like right there, I think that's like 11 teams. So at that stage, they might not even make the playoffs, let alone the play-in. And then their roster, it's just polar opposites because you got Curry at 36, Chris Paul at 38, Wiggins at 29, Green at 34. And then you go to the other side, you got Kuminga at 21, Moody at 21, Pazinski at 21, and Jackson Davis at 24. And it kind of feels like they're too late now to sort of trade those guys and get a package to compete now with this team, with Curry especially. So I think they just kind of have to ride it out. And look, I think the most interesting talking point is Klay Thompson. I mean, 0 points today, 0 from 6 from 3. There was one point where the Warriors got out in transition and they passed on the ball, and not once he pulled a Michael Porter Jr. He just shot it up and completely bricked it. And I don't know. I mean, do you bring him back or do you let him walk? Because like from a culture standpoint, you kind of have to bring him back. But at the same time, if you do bring him back, you can't exactly bench him and give him DNPs because it's Klay Thompson. And also, you're not going to give him a contract. For me, if he gets 15 million a year, that's ridiculous. I don't think he's worth like 10 million at this point. There's how many shooters are there out there in the league that you can go and get? So for me, I wouldn't bring him back just because I think it's going to hurt the development of those younger guys. But I'm interested to see what you guys think.
Yuri?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough one, right? Considering he's been there since he was drafted all the way back in 2011, given him such great service. We've seen so many great Game 6 Klay outings over the years, right? From that 41-point performance against OKC in the 2016 Western Conference Finals and the whole of the other games galore. But when you look at it, right, too, he's probably going to have to take way less money. Because Golden State this season, Bobby Marks at ESPN, who does all the financial statements and all the mathematical equations with teams' payrolls, Golden State paid $382.5 million for their team this season, which was the most out of all the 30 NBA teams. So I think it just speaks volumes, right, of what they'll have to do to sort of give him less of a pay anyway, considering, yes, he's just completed what his 5-year extension, which he signed in July of 2019, but he's not the same player as what he used to be before, right? When he Every time you just step into a three to ball, you'd know it would automatically go in. But as we saw today against the Kings, he had so many good, clean looks from three, especially where he just bricked them in and out. And that was just pretty sort of sad to see in that way, too. So that's sort of, it's a very difficult choice, though. And I think probably one of the reasons maybe you could say that Bob Myers, the former Warriors GM, left because it, for him having to make that decision, if he was still the general manager, to say, "Well, Clay, we can't give you a max contract anymore because you're turning 35 next February, and we feel as though you're past your prime. But we feel as though we, if you want a 2-year deal worth maybe 30, 35 million, then will you accept that just for that regard too?" And we've seen superstars over the years take pretty significant pay cuts, right? Dirk Nowitzki took one in, I'm pretty sure, 2011 or 2012. To get veteran players to build around the Dallas Mavericks. So we'll see what happens in regards to that too. But just further sort of context on the game today, we saw when Steph Curry had the ball, that two Kings players went to double team him and forced the ball out of his hands. I think that really disrupted Golden State's usual motion offense. And it definitely left Curry rattled for sure too. He missed quite a few considerable clean looks that he would normally knock down. And Sacramento pushing in transition was such a key component, right? Them running up and down the floor, which has been a real shift, right, in their whole sort of DNA offensive mentality under Mike Brown these last couple of seasons. And the offensive rebounding too. How many tip outs were there, right, that the Kings got? And they were quicker to those loose balls. They had what, 15 offensive rebounds to Golden State's 8. I think the Warriors didn't even have an offensive rebound in the opening half. So that pretty much told you, right? Once Trayce Jackson-Davis went to the bench, he only played, I think, 11 minutes for the entire game. And it was pretty much a field day for Sabonis to really capitalize as he's always done throughout his career on the glass. And yeah, I think just really told those younger Sacramento Kings legs, eventually wearing down the Warriors, and it was a thoroughly well-deserved performance from them.
Okay, well, that was basketball today. It was a great day of basketball. We might as well throw to the Eastern Conference. We've got four rounds to preview. Tom, we can start you off with Boston versus everybody. They could either play the Bulls, the Hawks, the 76ers, or the Heat. I'll tell you right now, I can't pick the Celtics over the Heat. I am contractually obligated after what happened last year to never bet against Jimmy Butler ever again. That being said, walk us through Boston's first round matchups.
Look, it's hard to really give this series an in-depth one. So I'll be quick because the other ones are more exciting to talk about because we know the matchups. I think, you know, the best matchup for the Celtics would be the Bulls. Most likely matchup probably going to be the Heat, which I'm already losing sleep over. But look, I'll purely just talk about the Celtics. I mean, they've had like the last month or so off. And look, they're ramping up now. It's almost like they're having a whole new season because today the reporters were saying that they had their hardest training session they've had all year long. And look, at the end of the day, Tatum's the best player on this team, but it's probably going to go as far as Porzingis takes them, which will be interesting because Porzingis this whole season has never really ramped it up. He's never really played like a 40-minute game. And, you know, we've rested him well and we've had the luxury of being able to do that. But if we play the Heat, he is going to be pivotal in that zone matchup of getting to the free throw line and basically just being that 7'3" guy who can shoot over anyone. I don't really know what to make of this Heat team, and I don't want to waste too much time because for all we know, they beat the 76ers tomorrow and this doesn't even matter, or they end up losing both play-in games, which I'd be shocked by, but you never know. But look, having gone off the last month and a bit of Heat basketball, it's not like it's been outstanding. And can they just suddenly flick the switch? It was sort of, you know, I mean, Jury can attest to this. When the Bucks won in 2021, everyone, when they got that first round matchup of Bucks Heat, everyone said the same thing, like, "Ooh, Miami Bucks!" Like Miami beat them in the playoffs last year, and then I can't exactly remember, but that was a 4-game sweep or a 5-game series or something like that.
5 games.
Yeah, 5 games exactly, and you know, everyone sort of just swept that under the rug, like, "Oh yeah, whatever." But the reality is that that's what the Heat can also bring in the playoffs. It's not like playoff Jimmy can just do what he did last year every year. I'll say that at the moment, I'm confident that the Celtics will make it out of the first round. But at the same time, they're one bad Porzingis fall away from being a completely different team.
Julian, Yuri, who are you picking?
Well, whoever Boston plays, right, I'd pick the Celtics, of course, anyway. That whole 64-18 record, which was their first season registering over 60 wins since the championship year in 2008. The thing is, though, the Celtics, right, and this is sort of the advantage that the elite teams have, is they can just switch up various matchups. And Boston, as Tom very well knows, inside out, they love to switch a lot. And that, in terms of the flexibility on having a big on a small right, and it doesn't feel as though they're at a disadvantage because they've got rim protection now of Porzingis, which they didn't have last season. Of course, Rob Williams's injury too didn't help matters here and there, so that was probably a little bit of their downfall when he went down. But that's the thing, though, when you have length all around from Jaylen Brown to Jason Tatum, you can play Horford and Porzingis together, even Jrue Holiday or Derek White, a point guard. You can have, which they've done all season with Derek White and Jrue Holiday. There's so many options that I think teams trying to scout for the Celtics are thinking, well, if we can somehow eliminate their three-point shooting, shall I say, and force them to drive into double teams, then that may be our best hope. But then the peril of that is what happens if Boston starts getting hot from three, because it's been countless times, right? Even Game 7 of the Milwaukee series a couple years ago, when Grant Williams got hot and knocked down 8 threes, and those are sort of the. It's one of those dangers that you run into as an opposition side, and the Bulls aren't a great defensive. Well, they were good for probably one half when Lonzo Ball was there in 21-22 before he went down with his knee injury. Atlanta's absolutely Swiss cheese defense, as Clyde Walt-Frazier loves to say, but if it's Miami that Boston ends up playing, well, there's going to be a lot of the same doghouse grind as we've seen for the last 12 years when the teams have faced each other in the playoffs. Last season, right, in Game 7, which, what, the Celtics scored only 84 points. That was pretty much just a calamitous struggle on offense, especially when Tatum rolled his ankle in what, the game's first or second possession, was hobbled right throughout. So, as Tom knows, and as I know very well too from last year, you can't really underestimate Miami if you end up playing them.
Julian, what about the Sixers? We have last year's league MVP in Joel Embiid. He was the best player in the league until he got injured early in the season. Back-to-back injuries, he missed the last game or so of the regular season with a knee tweak after missing several months, or shouldn't say several, but a couple months with an MCL sprain. Do you see a Sixers possibility upset over the Celtics in the first round?
Over, not over the Celtics, over the Heat I'd can, but not over the Celtics. No way. I think Embiid, he's still, we don't even know the extent of his injury. They're just not releasing the full details. They're not going to admit anything. And even if he was playing at even 85% fitness, his unfamiliarity with Lowry, Payne, and Buddy Hield, and even Oubre Jr. in the starting lineup, it's probably not enough for him to take over a strong team like the Celtics. So yeah, not confident on that game at all
All
if it's the
right,
Sixers.
we're all going to pick Boston, but let's be real, we don't know the matchup yet. So it's a tentative Boston. The next matchup is the 4-5, the Cleveland Cavaliers versus the Orlando Magic. The Cavs, they were predicted to win about 50 games this year. They ended on 48, mostly as the result of injuries to everybody on that team, it felt like. The Magic overperformed as well. They had a really good end to last season, if you don't remember, and then come out of the gates firing. They finished with 47 wins, 35 losses. I think this is two similar-ish teams. They play kind of a grinding defense, and their offense kind of gets stifled depending on what's going on. Cleveland's defense hasn't been as good as last year's to the eye test. I haven't looked at the analytics. Magic, I think the best player in this series is Donovan Mitchell. Paolo Banchero is a killer, though, and I just want to sing that name a couple times. He has off nights where he goes, 3 of 16 from the floor, but he's very good. The key for this series for me, for Cleveland, is health. They have issues all over the floor, big men, small men, middle men with injuries. And the Magic often struggle with shooting. I don't see a really good solution. They have guys who can get hot off the bench like Cole Anthony, but this is a really interesting matchup for me. Probably the least interesting to, casual fans in the Eastern Conference. I see it going 7 games. I picked the Magic, Yuri, Jules, Tom, in that order.
Yeah, I just think this game, the whole series, and especially I think 4 or 5 matchups in either the East or Western conferences are always hard to determine what's going to happen in the outcome, Alex. And we've seen many great 4 or 5 matchups throughout the years. But with this encounter, right, I think the season series was, I think, finished at 2 apiece, if I'm not mistaken, too. And the big part for Cleveland is how much do they stick with Evan Mobley and Jared Allen at the same time together in the front court, because Orlando, they can play Jonathan Isaac at power forward with Wendell Carter Jr. They play a bit of Jonathan Isaac at center in their regular season finale against Milwaukee. And that guy, since coming back from those, what, two torn ACL injuries that he's had, and he's spent a long time on the sidelines, he can. I wouldn't be surprised though, Alex, if he guards Donovan Mitchell. And that sounds completely outlandish, but to completely disrupt Donovan, I think that would be the absolutely number one downfall to the Cavaliers. And especially when it comes to half court offense too, and what Orlando's able to do to get their defense set, it's super hard to contain. And that is the issue, I think, with the Cavaliers in regards to half court offense for them. But for Orlando, it's more just about wanting to attack the paint. And there's something we've spoken about too about them is they don't take a bunch of threes. And the 3-point shooting is pretty mediocre, if you want to use that term anyway, too. So there's a heavy reliance on their sort of attacking the paint and getting layups and feeding Wendell Carter Jr. every now and then, too, because he definitely tends to go under the radar within their whole offense. But Joe Ingles, that's the other one, too, is how many minutes does veteran Joe play? Because he's their best 3-point shooter, right? You have Gary Harris, who's been a pretty good 3-point shooter throughout his career. How much does he play? And you have such a long contingent of guards there with Cole Anthony. And also with Markelle Fultz and how they split those minutes. It's one of those really fascinating, I think, pointers for Orlando too, and their first return to the playoffs since 2020 and this whole rebuild that they've been through. It's going to be extremely interesting as well. And the battle on the boards, that's the other part too, because Orlando's a pretty good rebounding team, so are the Cavaliers, and it's going to be an absolute battle of attrition between Wendell Carter Jr., right, Jared Allen, and also Evan Mobley in there too. And Goga Bitadze and Moritz Wagner as well, Mo Wagner. How many minutes do they play too to back up Wendell Carter Jr. just in case he gets in foul trouble? So yeah, a lot of interesting points to sort of assess as this series wears on.
Jules, Tom, anything else on this series?
I mean, I've talked a lot about the Magic in the last few podcasts, and as much as I love them, I just think they rely so heavily on their second unit when it's the normal season and teams are rotating their starters. But when it's the playoffs, when they're, that kind of goes out the window and the teams sort of increase the minutes for the main players, I don't know if they have enough offensive power, especially the Cavaliers definitely have the edge in their backcourt with Mitchell and Garland. You can stop one of them, and the Lander are very good at stopping the main person, but then someone else, if they pay a lot of attention to Mitchell, as Yuri pointed out, then Garland steps up, and I
Sam
don't know.
Bloody
I just,
Merrill.
yeah, him too. One of the best 3-point shooters going around. So, yeah, I would love to see the Magic take it to game seven, but I think the Cavaliers will get this one.
Tom.
I'll just read you out directly what I've got in my notes. I've just got, probably going to be a rock fight, potential to be one of the least watched NBA playoff series maybe ever. Thing to watch out for is this Donovan's last couple games in a Cavs uniform,
Yes, it
and
will
my
be.
prediction: Magic in seven, purely because the Cavs pissed off the basketball gods by punting away that game against the Hornets to not get the 3 seed on that last day. And I don't like that. I don't think teams are ever rewarded when they do stuff like that.
Rue the day you piss off the basketball gods. Yuri, who did you end up picking? No, Jules. You had the Cavs. Yuri, who
I've
did you
gone
pick?
Cavs, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so I've got, oh, that's a tough
It's
one, Ricky.
tough.
You know you
If
put
you
me on
can't
the
split
spot,
it, you can't
Alex.
split it because I can't split Cavs and Mavericks
It's a
when we
tough
get to
one.
it. Yeah, I'll just say it's 50-50 for Yuri because that is a real tough. It's hard to figure out. I had Magic in seven. All right, Jules, we got 5 minutes till we head to the break. The Knicks versus either the 76ers or the Miami Heat, depending on how the bracket breaks. How do you see this potential series?
Well, I'll talk more about the Sixers and the Heat game, but yeah, one thing I will touch on is, did anyone watch that Knicks versus Bulls game? That was one of the best games I think I've watched. The final quarter was so exciting, but oh, Tibbs was just fuming on the bench because the Knicks, they made some really pivotal errors when they were up. They sort of were just throwing the ball away in the last, I think, 40 seconds, are up by 4 points, and they turned it over. They just did some things that were really concerning for a team that wants to close out a game. And I think Tom mentioned in last week's podcast, which I was listening to, that Jalen Brunson can only do so much before they come across a really good team. And I don't know, personally, if the Sixers beat the Heat, I could see the Sixers beating the Knicks as well. But yeah, just to touch on the Heat Sixers game, because obviously that's who's going to play the Knicks. Again, we talked about Embiid before having a bit of unfamiliarity with Payne and Buddy Hield and stuff. But at the moment, I don't know if Miami has all the key pieces to get it right against him. Embiid is still at 75%. He's still a fantastic player. But interesting to note, in the 13 times that Embiid has played Adebayo, he's only scored over 30 on two occasions. So 11 out of 13 games, which is 85%, he scored under 30. So it'd be interesting to see, actually, for those prop bettors out there, how he actually scores, because for 10 out of his last 10 games at home, Embiid has actually scored 41 points, 41 points, 70, 37, and 32. So it'll be interesting to see how historical data influences his prop markets for this bet, for this game moving ahead. But I think the real difference in that game is going to be Tyrese Maxey, because he's been someone that the Heat have not been able to stop. In the four games he's played, he had one game where he was off in a Christmas game, which I watched. He was 4 from 20 from the field. But in the other three games where Maxey has played Miami, he scored 30 points, 30 points, and 37 points with a bunch of assists and rebounds as well. So who draws the Maxey assignment? Well, a lot of attention will be on Embiid. So, do you quell his influence or do you stop Maxey? And who do they put on him? Well, do they go with Jimmy Butler from the start, or do they put someone like a Caleb Martin on Maxey? Or do they put someone like a Highsmith on him or a D'Lon Wright to try and quell his influence? And then obviously Tobias Harris, I've been talking about how bad he is more than anyone on this podcast. He needs to step up and he needs to show something, whether it's in defense on Jimmy Butler or whether he can somehow get on the offensive, offensive scoring as well. So yeah, we'll be interested to see who wins that game, and then we can talk about the Knicks as well. But yeah, I see it playing out that the Sixers can beat the Heat, and then the Sixers can take the Knicks as well.
Tom.
Look, if the Knicks end up playing the Heat, I'd be a little bit concerned because last year, the Heat beat them in six, and Brunson averaged 31 points, 6.3 assists, 5.5 rebounds, and that was with Randle. With no Randle, it might be a bit of a struggle. The 76ers, I think the 76ers are just being a bit overrated. I mean, Embiid looks to be about 70%. To win a series, you need him to be at 100%, and you need him to have the ability to play 40-plus minutes. And he doesn't have either of them right now. If this is a quick game, if the Knicks decide to pick up their pace and just give it to Brunson, DiVincenzo, Hart to just race up that court, Embiid's going to not even cross the halfway line before the Knicks get a shot up, which just is going to be concerning. And then, look, this is probably the Knicks' best chance of making a conference finals, you'd have to think, because if they beat the 76ers or the Heat, then they've got to play the Bucks or the Pacers, which we'll touch on, in the next half of the show. But who knows what Giannis is going to be like. And then if it ends up being the Pacers, I think the Knicks can easily beat the Pacers. So Knicks are going to take this chance. I know they've got injuries, but they've got to take this chance. Otherwise, they might end up regretting it.
Yeah, I think if the 76ers get through, the Knicks do it pretty easily. I don't think Embiid's healthy, but I am unable to bet against the Miami Heat. That would be a fun series, Knicks versus Heat. Anyway, it's my favorite part of the show. I throw to Tom Dev to get to the break. I think he's starting to prepare himself before he comes to the show because I don't prepare him, and now I think he gets what's happening. But Tom, take it away.
No, look, I'm not fully prepared today, but look, while we're on the subject of the Knicks, I don't know if anyone saw today, but the video that they presented to LeBron James got leaked, and it was just hysterical. They had Tony Soprano in there, being obviously Tony Soprano. Go watch it if you haven't seen it, but I think that's what we need to start doing. We need to start hiring some A-grade celebrities to throw to the break. But look, we'll see if we get an A-grade celebrity on the second half of this show.
Spoiler alert, you're not.
Busting open the second half of the show, Yuri. We're going to talk about the Bucks Pacers, your Milwaukee Bucks. Bit of a rivalry that started earlier this year with the Indiana Pacers. Now, fair, the Pacers were playing a little bit better, but talk us through how you see this 3-6 matchup.
It's going to be one interesting series, that's for sure, Alex. The teams will converge for the first playoff meeting in 24 years since 2000, which in Indiana won that opening round series back when it was a best of five. It was the 1-8 matchup at the time, which Travis Best hit that clutch three from the left baseline corner back then, which really broke the Bucks' hearts. But with this series, right, as we saw during the regular season, Indiana won 4-5, including, of course, that in-season tournament final to get to what the final pretty much anyway. It was pretty much what the Eastern Conference in-season tournament final. But yeah, I think there's a lot of concerns. I think if you're a Milwaukee fan with Indiana's up-tempo offense, because that was ranked in the top two this season, they really take no breaks with their offense. They love to push the ball up down the floor with Tyrese Haliburton there facilitating the offense. You've got shooters wide open too, even though, of course, they don't have Benedict Mathurin, who's ruled out for the rest of the season, of course. But you got Miles Turner there, who's I think is just that real big key cog piece within Indiana's offense, right? He can pick and pop. His three-point shooting, yes, he only shoots, what, 33, 34% from deep. But when he knocks down three, four, five three-pointers, he's extremely lethal from there. And you add him and Pascal Siakam together at front court, which is meshed incredibly well as the season's rolled on. And Siakam can take a lot of pressure off Haliburton in terms of facilitating. He's a great passer. He has tremendous court vision too. And they're just a very unselfish team, the Pacers. They just seem to pick the right players in the right spots at the right time. And when you have very good three-point shooting, which the Pacers do, that's going to be the Bucks' real threat, I think. That's the worry. And Milwaukee's had those issues. Yes, Doc Rivers has somewhat revitalized or resuscitated the defense, but it hasn't been to the fullest extent of being, oh, we're a top five defensive team now, we'll beat anybody. No, that's hardly far from the truth. And that's where the worry really aligns, because in all five of our regular season meetings, the Pacers scored over 110 points. And that's just the real, I think, concern. Again, if you're a Milwaukee Bucks fan and having not having Giannis for the first half of this series, as the Bucks have reported through, of course, that left calf injury, the soleus muscle tear, which he hurt and was ruled after the final three games of the regular season. So I think the front court starting lineup with Bobby and Brook, and which they did against Atlanta in the conference finals in 2021, I think that will work fine. Both of them, Bobby, of course, provided so much energy throughout that series. And that's going to be a really interesting part. Him taking on the challenge against Pascal Siakam, Brook Lopez's shot blocking. How much is that going to really come into effect too? Because Miles Turner's also another great shot blocker. And within, I think, for Indiana too, they've had the same problems defensively. They just haven't been able to guard consistently, even though, yes, it has, they've taken good strides in their defensive commitment, but for the full 48 minutes, that has sort of dipped in and out too for them. So that's sort of the one to really watch out for. I think TJ McConnell was, what, pretty much the unsung hero in that playing tournament game, right? Remember the in-season tournament, should I say, and provided so much sort of havoc in that final period. So that'll be another intriguing one to watch as well, with how many minutes does Rick Carlisle give TJ, especially within those important stages too. But
Who are you
it's
picking?
just,
Do you believe in the Bucks? Because you're starting to glow a bit on the Pacers.
I've my skepticism, should I say, Alex. I've got us winning in 7 games. I feel like this series is going to go to distance. I can't sort of put a pinpoint answer as to why. I sort of hope
I could
that
give you a
the
couple.
lineup change,
Your shithead
which
coach,
Doc made,
Chris Middleton's getting
yes,
old. Brook Lopez is.
would pa
Props to Brook
yep.
Lopez after the back surgery and still being productive. Giannis Antetokounmpo is injured. I can give you plenty of reasons why it's you might feel a bit of skepticism, Yuri. But okay, Bucks and seven.
Yep.
Yeah, fair assessment, Tom and Jules. Bucks.
Yeah, look, it's kind of hard to pick as well because you just don't know what Giannis is going to be like if he does come back. We're assuming he's going to come back, but they're very vague on it. I mean, I flagged this at the start of the year when we were doing a preview or something that, Giannis has struggled to be healthy. It's unfortunate. It's not like it's a recurring injury, but, this is his fourth playoff series in the last 5 years that he's going to be injured to either start or during. The one thing I want to flag is Pascal Siakam is kind of not exactly a playoff riser since that finals run. He's only averaged in the 2 postseason appearances 19.1 points, 7.4 rebounds, 4.5 assists, and that's in 17 games. He's going to need to step up. It doesn't really feel like he added much to this Pacers team like we thought he would. Overall, though, this is probably going to be about who can score the most. I mean, the Pacers we know can score like 140 when they're on. But I think this Bucks thing, I think this is where they right the ship somewhat. And I'm going Bucks in six at the moment.
Bucks in six. Now, see, I had the opposite opinion. I think it's whoever scores the most. I don't think Giannis is playing the first 2 games. I've got the Pacers. And to be honest, if Giannis doesn't play, I don't think it gets close. Jules?
I'm going to back Yuri, knowing his Bucks, and go with the Bucks.
All righty. We might stick with you, Jules, really quickly. What was the segment we had for you? The Wolves and Suns? Is that what we pegged you for in the West?
Yeah, I can talk about that. I watched the Wolves, the full Wolves Suns game the other day, and did you guys happen to watch that game by any chance? I
I
know, Alex,
watched the
you don't watch a
highlights of
lot of
that
Suns,
game.
Alex. That's one of
You know
your
my rule. You know my
yeah,
rule.
yeah.
I'll be
Is
able to
that
watch
is
them now. It's the playoffs.
that's right. You're out of hiding now with the Idaho Nation with the Suns. You can watch them finally. Well, if you'd watched that game against the Wolves, you probably would have seen a few gaps in the Timberwolves game that I haven't personally seen until I watched them against the Suns. And the Suns got really hot. And that's obviously that happens. So it's I don't want to jump to any conclusions yet, but if they play that way against the Wolves and the Wolves play how they played, it's going to be a Suns victory across the 7 games here. But the Wolves being the number one defensive team and across the season, obviously they have a lot of credibility. But some things that I wanted to note as I was watching this game, I was just jotting a few things down. And Bradley Beal obviously had 16 points in the first quarter. He was 4 from 4 from downtown, 6 out of 7 field goals to start the game. And it was 44 points to the Suns, I believe, in the first quarter, 44 to 22. And, huge statement from them. And what's really interesting about the Suns is they're definitely a confidence team. Like the difference between them being hot versus ice cold is just so, it's night and day. And we saw it when Bradley Beal got hot and Devin Booker and Durant, they have this really good understanding between the three of them where they just, if one of them's hot, the other two just sort of step aside. And they knew that Bradley Beal was on that game and they sort of just, I mean, Booker was still scoring, but they sort of like took a back seat a little bit and they let Beal cook. And yeah, the Timberwolves, they were pressed a little bit on the defense. Grayson Allen was sort of pushing out a little bit. And what it forced the Wolves to do when Edwards wasn't hot was to use Gobert in isolation. And this is where I see the Wolves having the biggest problem because he is not a good one-on-one player down low where like a Vucevic or Embiid where he can sort of get the ball where there's 5 or 6 seconds left. The play sort of stopped and you're relying on that center to do, to pull up or to ISO. That's where they're going to get exposed, I think. So I'm really, really keen to see how that matchup goes because he was actually, I think he was only on 2 or 4 points until Nurkic got himself into foul trouble and then Gobert suddenly went to town on Eubanks. But when Nurkic was out there, Gobert could not get to the rim at all. And as I said, Allen put a little bit of pressure on Edwards and suddenly the Timberwolves couldn't get anything going. They got a bit of a spark from McLaughlin on the bench, but really, they looked really out of it. Alexander Walker was getting torn apart. He couldn't do anything. They tried switching McDaniels onto Booker and Beal. It wasn't working. So, yeah, as I say, I know as I say this, the Suns have been super hot and cold, so I can't really draw too many conclusions from that last game. But that was a big win, a very playoff feel about that game. And the Timberwolves just booked that game. So, I don't know. I have the Suns win this game purely based on what I saw. But as we know with basketball, you know, one game doesn't necessarily, you know, mean everything for the future game. So, yeah, keen to hear what you think.
Well, I've got the Wolves because I haven't seen a single Suns game in the last well, 4 months. So that's by default. But Tom, your thoughts?
Look, Bradley Beal has the potential to be the X factor. It kind of feels like this last week he's sort of discovered it. I mean, those last 10 games, he's averaged 19.3 points, 5.5 rebounds, 4.5 assists, and he's shot over 40% in 8 of those games. That game he had against the Kings, where he basically won it down the stretch with his defense, was just outstanding. It's probably the best stretch I've seen him have in one single game in a long time. I think what's going to be really exciting is to see if Jaden McDaniels guards Booker or Kevin Durant. I mean, Durant's obviously going to have a bit more size on him, but he's one of the best defenders in the league. I think it's going to be Timberwolves in seven, just because, you know, like Jules said, the Suns are just so hot and cold, where I could see the Suns winning one game by 15 points and then losing the next one by 30. So I think the Timberwolves are more consistent, although Ant Edwards just can't have another game where he scores 13 like he did against the Suns the other day.
Yuri, you've got 10 seconds because we're running out of time to talk about every other matchup.
Okay, so I've got the Timberwolves winning this series in seven games too, Alex. I think it's just going to completely go the distance. The other just quick one too, the minutes for the Suns as well. We saw later in the regular season that pretty much all their starters played 35 plus minutes. So that's just one to watch out for too.
Yeah, three of us got Wolves in seven. It'd be interesting to see how that goes. All right, next matchup is the Nuggets versus Lakers, the 2-7 matchup after the Lakers sneaked through today. And the defending champions lost that last game of the season against the Spurs, if not the second last game of the season, sorry. The 2-7 matchup. So this was a 3-0 series sweep to the Nuggets against LA this year. It's a repeat of last year's conference finals, which might have been the closest series sweep of all time, the Lakers losing all four games. But it was a good series. We can all kind of, you know, it was close for most of those games. I've got two keys. I've got one for the Lakers and one for Denver. Denver's key to the series for me is Aaron Gordon. So we know sometimes the Lakers' size can be an issue. Obviously, Anthony Davis, tremendous defensive player. But you've got LeBron James, Rui Hachimura, or, you know, the ghost of Gabe Vincent's ankles playing the other forward spots. Aaron Gordon's really solidified himself into those slot cut roles. He's got that 1-2 man game with Nikola Jokic able to throw, they look like shots, but they're just off the rim and Gordon goes up and dunks. If you've got a 47-year-old LeBron James defending that, or Rui Hachimura, who's pretty good, but he's not great, I think there's a lot of wiggle room for Aaron Gordon to be super impactful. And my key to the series for the Lakers is D'Angelo Russell. We saw it today. He got hot. He's made a bit of a trend of it up and down this season. Last year, he averaged, I think I've still got it up in front of me, but in last year's four-game series, D'Angelo Russell averaged 6.3 points, shooting 13% from three. He does a little bit better than that, and one or two of those games get pushed into overtime or in the Lakers' way. So I had this series as Nuggets in six. I don't think it'll be as easy for Denver as it was last year. LeBron James knows his time is running out. He's going to push it. I think this is the best season I've seen Anthony Davis play probably ever. You know, you could put it on par with a couple of his peak seasons. I have Nuggets in six. Tom?
Yeah, look, I think this will be different than the last time we saw them in the playoffs just because LeBron will get to rest. He won't have to play every other day. But I've still got Denver in five, and I'm going to predict in that one Lakers win, they're going to, you know, win the free throw count by at least 20.
Jules?
Yeah, I'm going Nuggets in five as well.
And Yuri, anything else to say?
I think I've got the Nuggets winning this in six. I feel as though the couple of games, I think LA will win at home, whether it's games three and four anyway they'll take. And then the other part to sort of watch out for probably is just within the whole Denver offense, they just surgically cut you apart. And that's sort of the worry for the Lakers. There was a few instances today, right, where LeBron was caught ball watching, which led to two Zion dunks. So you can't afford that, especially Jokic having the ball in his hands from the top. And, oh, Michael Porter Jr., you cut this way, LeBron. Oh, sorry, mate, didn't see you. So those are things that I think they can't afford to get into those lapses. Otherwise, it's just going to be a Nuggets field day in the paint.
I'm going to love to watch this series. All right, Tom, you've got the Clippers Mavs matchup, the 4-5 in the West. I can't call this one, although we don't know. I think we don't know the state of Kawhi Leonard for, what feels like the 10th time in the last couple of years. Doubtful with a knee injury heading into the playoffs. Talk us through this 4-5 matchup.
Well, exactly. This is another matchup where the injury cloud has sort of made it hard to pick. I mean, the last time Kawhi had a nondescript knee injury, it turned out to be his ACL, and the Clippers said he was day to day, which is absolute rubbish. And if Kawhi isn't 100%, can Paul George and James Harden step up? Notorious playoff chokers. I don't really think so. One to really note though is Luka Doncic has averaged 33.5 points, 9.5 assists, and 8.8 rebounds in 13 playoff games against the Clippers. He's scored over 40 in 5 of those games. Like, he cooks these guys. And now all of a sudden, the Clippers have notorious defender James Harden on the perimeter. Like, I am seriously scared to what call for what Luka could potentially do to this team. And Kyrie, he's looked like the best number two since the last, what, since maybe the All-Star break. He's been really consistent and good. Best he's looked since 2017.
Is
The
LeBron
only
James the
concern for
number
me
two?
is
That I just want to clarify. Is LeBron the number two on the Lakers?
no.
So, okay. So he's maybe Anthony Davis is the number two. So Kyrie, the second best number two in the league?
No, I'm not saying the league. I'm saying the last few months. From a
Okay.
consistency standpoint and from a winning standpoint, I take winning into account. I mean, the
Okay.
Lakers haven't exactly been doing a whole lot of winning.
No, I'm not against you. I'm just feeling it out.
Look, if anyone wants to diss Kyrie, you best believe it's going to be me. So for me to give you credit, it hurts. It hurts a lot. The Mavs' depth does concern me. I mean, if Luka and Kyrie combine for 90 points, they're still going to need others to chip in. Hardaway Jr. hasn't looked great in a while. None of their other role players are consistent. They can get hot, but they're not consistent. And it's kind of what you need in the series. Whereas, you look at the Clippers, they got Norman Powell, they got Westbrook who can come off the bench and really, be a 1-2 sucker punch. Whereas the Mavs don't really have that. I mean, Dante Exum's been good, but he hasn't, we haven't really seen it for a long stretch of the year. So at the moment, my prediction, I reckon, is just Mavs in six, just purely because it doesn't feel like Kawhi's going to be 100%. PG and Harden are playoff chokers, and I just really want a victory lap about my take when I said that I don't take this Clippers team seriously.
Jules, your thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Tom. I'm going to go the Mavs as well.
Yuri, any other thoughts?
Oh, it's another hard one to choose. I'll probably have to say line ball 50-50 for the time being. And with
Yeah.
Kawhi's availability for game one still up in the air too, it sort of does draw a little bit of concern too. And I think Dallas's overall improved play right since what they were just over 500 in what late January to sort of transform their season as they have done. And the Clippers sort of defensively was there were a few issues which Ty Lue had to iron out. So we'll see what happens in that regard and whether they're able to sort of rectify that too, and whether it's enough time to really salvage it. So
Yeah,
time will tell with that.
super interesting. The Clippers were the best team in the league for 6 weeks. The Mavs down the stretch kind of showed us they could be the best team in the league, led by a guy who a lot of people gave serious MVP consideration to in Luka Doncic. All right, moving on. Who have we got left? Yuri,
Thunder.
Thunder and Kings or Thunder and Pels? Which will it be? It's the 1-8 matchup in the West. OKC nabbing that. The youngest team in the league, the youngest team to make the playoffs, nabbing the number one seed at the end of the series. We saw the Pels looked really good today. Go ahead.
Okay, so I don't have a winner yet for Pels and Kings, but I'll just start with the Pels if they do play the Thunder. I think this would be a pretty good matchup. We spoke about this only a couple of episodes ago, which we thought was a potentially 3v6 matchup, and of course didn't end up that way. But I think the Pelicans' size would definitely cause a lot of problems for the Thunder. If they're able to get through, they're able to switch a fair bit and throw multiple defenders on SGA, either Herb Jones or Trey Murphy when Herb's off the floor, or even a Brandon Ingram. And Ingram's not a bad defender. I think an area of his defensive game which he's gotten better at as the years have gone on. And I think offensively too, JV Valanciunas, if he plays more minutes than he did today and for what the last couple of games before that, in trying to batter down Chet Holmgren, because he does have a weight advantage on his end, Jonas, especially if the Pels do throw it down to him, which they did against the Lakers today to really test out Davis's back. There was probably about three or four possessions, right, where the Pels went, oh, we'll just throw it down to JV. You go to work and really try and make AD sweat as much as possible, which, yeah, they did. He missed quite a few easy hook shots here and there. But I think it's one if the Pels do advance that they can really utilize, I think, to their advantage. And also 3-point shooting, too. OKC is a pretty good 3-point shooting team. And the Pels, I think, were ranked in the top five this season, even though their volume of 3-point shooting was pretty low and was in the bottom 10 out of all 30 teams this season. So that's just my observation. The Pelicans do get through against the Thunder. And as for the Kings, well, I think what the Thunder took three or four, but a couple of them, the Kings really pushed them, including that 105-98 win earlier in the season. I think that was a mid-November game, and the one recently too that the sides faced, which the Kings were right in until SGA took over and scored 40 points. And they've got a few options here and there if they want to switch in terms of their matchups by having Keegan Murray play on SGA. They've got Keon Ellis, who's a pretty feisty defender. He's also another option that they can use too. And I think Sacramento's, you could say, it's not a triangle offense, but it's very motion offense in a way too. Sabonis operating from the top and doing his fancy behind the back passes or seeing the screen after delivering a butt behind the back, should I say, a pass behind his through his legs. And it's just those type of plays, which I think the Kings can really trouble the Thunder through motion. But the other part to it as well of OKC is that they love to get their shooters running off screens wide open. I think that's a concern if you're Sacramento. And although they didn't really have to encounter too much of that today because they defended extremely well and against Curry, where they basically put two men on the ball and forced the ball out of his hands. That's another tactic if they do advance through that they can put on SGA and could well somehow stifle his influence and say, well, Lou Dort, you got to go for 25, 30 points. We'll try and have all those other guys try and beat us instead of SGA. So it's a really fascinating point too. And I think also for OKC being the number one seed, early doors right this season, it probably wasn't a surprise that they're going to finish as a top three, top four team in the Western Conference. They got off that really good start and have maintained it along the way too, right? And the youngest ever team to finish on top of the West. For, I think, on top of any conference, so what the average age was about 24 years of age, and with a 57-25 record, the only probably you could say maybe pointer that may be at their disadvantage is playoff experience with SGA and Lou Dort being the only ones there out of the Thunder contingent have had
You
playoff
got
experience.
Gordon
Yeah, Gordon
Hayward.
Hayward has. Yeah, Gordon Hayward for Boston and Utah, but just within the whole sort of dynamic, those two have
Vasilije
already
Mircic has
experienced it,
played in the
right?
EuroLeague. He's 30 years old. He's got some playoff experience overseas. No, but you're right. Yuri, this is a very young and inexperienced team. Does anyone not have the Thunder coming out of the first round? Shakes from Tom. Jules is thinking about it, but it's a subtle
No,
shake.
I don't want to. I don't want to overthink it. I think they're Thunder. They're the number one seed for a reason. And 33-8 at home. I don't want to overthink it. I think they're going to fly past.
Last six games against the Pelicans, the Thunder have won four of them. The two losses were a 3-point and 4-point loss, and then two of those four victories were blowouts. So Thunder have the rub over the Pels. I didn't look at the Kings. I think the Kings are a bit of bigger threat. But you know what? We're running out of time for today's show, so we're all picking the Thunder in the West. That's it for our playoff previews. We've got a couple items of news to get to before the end of the show. We're going to rapid fire, and then I'll put a question to you in a second. Nets, the Brooklyn Nets, they're going to hire Jordy Fernandez as coach moving forward. He's the former top assistant at the Kings. He spent several seasons with Mike Malone at the Nuggets. Currently, the head coach of Team Canada, who've been playing really well in international play, including the FIBA World Cup. I think they've actually, I should check that if they've already qualified for the Olympics or if they're in one of the qualifying tournaments in the next couple of weeks or so. But good coach. Be interesting to see what Brooklyn does forward because if that's, I think that for me, that's the team. That just sucks at every level. The players suck. The fans suck. Why would you want to be the second team in New York? Anyway, I'm getting hangry, guys. Let's get through this so I can get to dinner. Grayson Allen re-signed with the Phoenix Suns on a 4-year, $70 million deal. I wanted to gauge a thumbs up or thumbs down from you guys on this deal. Allen's averaged 13.5 points, 46% from three this season. So give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down on 4 years, $70 million. Thumbs up from Tom, thumbs up from Yuri, thumbs up from Jules. They're all giving me actual thumbs in the chat as well. I don't know if that was necessary. We spoke about Kawhi Leonard's status for game one against the Mavericks. They're not really saying if we should expect him for the series. And then earlier this week, Blake Griffin retired from the NBA. So my question to you, is Blake Griffin a Hall of Famer? I'm going to read out some stats and some cherished memories from his career. He averages over his career 19 points, 8 rebounds, 4 assists, shooting nearly 50% from the floor. He was the 2010-2011 Rookie of the Year. He obviously missed out that first season with the leg injury. He's a six-time All-Star, five of those happening with the Clippers in his first 5 years, then a break of 4 years, and a sixth All-Star appearance with Detroit, and a five-time All-NBA appearances. His best year for me was with Detroit at the age of 30. 24.5 points, 7.5 rebounds, 5.5 assists. He averaged in the playoffs in 2014-15 across 14 games, 26 and 13. He had a 50-point game against Joel Embiid in an overtime win in October of 2018. In his first year in the league, Blake Griffin, 10th in MVP voting. Can you remember that? And in his fourth year, he was third in MVP voting. I think that's the 14-15 season. He was the 2011 slam dunk contest winner. We all remember him jumping partially or next to Akia. He's top 100 all time in the league for win shares per 48. I think he's 50th in box plus minus. He's around all these interesting stats for career wise, and he's made $260 million across his career. Most recently with the Boston Celtics, Tom Dev, is Blake Griffin a Hall of Famer?
No, we got to start cutting this off somewhere here, guys. Otherwise, everyone's getting in the Hall of Fame. But the reality is, for me, the more concerning thing for most players is the quicker you have to go to the fact that they have a gold medal, the quicker they shouldn't be in
I
the Hall
didn't
of
bring it
Fame. The
up.
fact that you can't. Well, the Blake Griffin hasn't even won a gold medal, has he?
I'm sure he had to be on one of those teams. I'm going to look really quickly while Julian Balthazar tells me whether or not Blake Griffin's in the Hall of Fame.
I've just got a visual.
Oh, he's giving me a thumbs down. We are an audio podcast. We don't put much of these out. And Yuri Bilsich, I would love your thoughts.
Unfortunately, I'd have to say no, and that's sort of pretty hard to say that considering his whole Clippers career, he was so consistent right throughout, and his whole sort of evolution as a shooter got so much better right from. I think it was late in his Clippers days where he started taking more threes. And of course, that transcended when he was playing for the Pistons because those knee injuries, which really sort of curtailed much of his high flying athleticism and high flying dunks. But he even if he doesn't make it right, he's still considered one of the really supreme dunkers the NBA's ever seen. I think that's the big thing as well with Blake.
I have him as the senior vice president of the Hall of Very Good. I think this is as good as it gets without making the Hall of Fame. Basketball Reference has his Hall of Fame predictability at 53%. I can't see a gold medal anywhere on his Wikipedia page. I know we should look at better places, but it's really unfortunate he got injured with Detroit. If he gets a couple other good se seasons under him, he can score a lot more points, get closer to, some of the marks we expect in the Hall of Fame. But I think this is as good as it gets without making the Hall of Fame. Interesting there. All right, performances of the week. We got to wrap up before we get going. I got to have dinner because I'm starting to get hangry in my belly. I'm sure you can hear the noises through my microphone. Tom, your performance of the week.
Look, last time we get to talk about this guy this year, so I had to, pick this one. But Wemby versus the Nuggets, 34 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 stocks, 5 of 12 from 3. That's crazy for a guy that tall. And he willed his team back from 23 points down. Can't wait to watch him in the Olympics and next season.
Possibly not the last time we talk about him. He's Defensive Player of the Year. I'm not saying it's locked up, but Julian, you had Rudy Gobert at like $18 at the time, so you've got to be feeling good about that one. Jules, performance of the week from you.
I wanted someone else who's been chosen, which I'll leave. So I'll go with Bradley Beal against the Wolves. He was fantastic with 36 points, 6 from 6 from 3, 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, and 1 block, and completely influential in the game.
I had Zion Williamson's 40-point, 11-rebound performance from today. It was the best Zion I've ever seen until he got injured. Yuri, last but not least, your performance of the week to end the show.
Jalen Brunson's 40 points in the overtime win against the Chicago Bulls. Just an absolute scoring team he's been on, right? I think this month of April, he averaged 35.9 points per game. His 28.7 points throughout the season is the most since Carmelo Anthony in 2012-13. And from about January, he averaged over 28 points pretty much in every single month. And it was unfortunate. And that was pretty much the way he had to do it anyway, considering Julius Randle was ruled out for the rest of the season. A lot of that offensive load was put on his shoulders. And he relished the challenge, and it's no surprise, right? And in such a contextual, pivotal game for the Knicks as well, with so much on the line, he just pretty much rode them all the way to that second seed. And
Was.
I think when it comes down to MVP voting, he should well be in the top five. That's just probably my viewpoint on it, just from the body of work and the circumstances that the Knicks have been through.
The next time you hear from us, I think we're going to have had a game one from every series in the West and the Eastern Conference. So tell a friend if they're looking for an NBA preseason, excuse me, an NBA playoff preview. Tell a friend if you're still here, please leave us a 5-star rating. I actually didn't see, Tom, you want to talk about anything for 30 seconds? I'm going to see how far up the charts we got last week.
Anything for 30 seconds. God, this one has put me on the spot.
That's how I did it.
Quick question. If you guys had to pick a celebrity to bring in a video to pitch to a star to come to your team, like who would it be? Because I mean, as a Boston fan, for me, it's probably going to be Mark Wahlberg or Ben Affleck. But what about you guys? Does Milwaukee have celebrities?
Oh, I don't know. We're a very small market team, Tom. We don't get much recognition, mate.
Can I have Aaron Rodgers just spewing all kinds of crap? That would surely bring some stars to your team. Kyrie Irving might come join.
Can we have Morgan Freeman?
Justin Bieber, surely. He's semi-popular now,
Oh,
right?
no. We're very civilized people in Milwaukee, mate.
No, I mean for Canada. He's from
Oh.
outskirts of Toronto. I've got the figures in front of me. We can stop vamping. All right, as you know, we've been tracking our rankings on the Basketball Australian podcast charts. You know, all of across the world get into the Australian charts. We peaked at 41 a couple of weeks ago, and we slowly tumbled down. First, it was 126, then it was 175, and then last week off the charts at 250. I am very pleased to report after last week's episode, we have rocketed back all the way up to 75.
Awesome.
I'll be the only one clapping. Can we try that again? Just I'll cut this so we're all clapping. Makes it sound like we got producers and fans. All right, so if you're still here through all that crap, please leave us a 5-star rating. See if we can bump up into the top 50. That'd be fun. I've been Alexander J. Julian Balthazar's just put the clap emoji on the Zoom chat. Yuri Bilsich is over there. Tom Dev's still in Melbourne. Thank you from all of us. That's been this week. We'll talk to you after what's going to be a great weekend and into the next week of NBA basketball. I love it. See you guys next week.
See you guys.
Thanks, Alex.
Cheers, Alex.